Spirit Radio Podcasts.
List. And I love receiving Christmas cards, and it's probably something we're not doing enough of nowadays because we rely, I don't know, on sending e-cards or texts or whatever. And I think we really appreciate them. But imagine how much you would appreciate a Christmas card if you were in prison being persecuted for your faith. Well, for a number of years, our next guest and his organisation have been involved in a project which basically does that. It sends Christmas cards to men and women who are behind bars simply because of their Christian faith. We'll also get an update today on Asya Bibi and her situation. I have David Turner, Director of Irish Charity Church and Chains, with me in the studio. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
So for those who haven't heard about the Christmas card project, tell us all about it.
Okay, it's a very simple idea, and what we would love everybody to do is to add one Christian prisoner to your Christmas card list. Most of us still send Christmas cards to family, to friends. So, you know, typically you'd buy a box of 10, 12, 20, depending on how many are in your family and how many friends you have. But just to take one of those cards and send it to a Christian prisoner overseas. So normally what we do, and we're doing the very same again this year, is we select three Christian prisoners in three countries, and we publish information about them. It's all on our website. You go to the homepage of our website and you'll see a Christmas card and click underneath that and you'll get all the information that you need. Now, it performs a very two vital tasks. One, as you've said, imagine if you're a prisoner, locked away, poor conditions, you're not seeing your family, your friends very much, and a card arrives from overseas and brings so much encouragement. Now, there are situations where sometimes prisoners are not allowed to receive the cards, but they are received in the prison. So, again, if you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who is working in a prison and a card comes in, they think, oh, that's interesting, a card has come for that Christian prisoner. But if the next day a few more cards come and a few more cards come, you begin to realise this prisoner is known about, lots of people know about him or her, and I'm going to be careful in how I treat this prisoner. And, you know, we don't know. I can't give you a guarantee, Wendy, that your Christmas card will get to any of the three prisoners that we're focusing on this year. But what I can guarantee you is that it'll get to the prison and it'll do a job there. But one of the stories that often encourages us in this project is that a few years ago, one of the prisoners that we focused on in our Christmas project was released from prison. And as well as bringing his belongings, he had to bring, I think, two sacks of post that had been received at that prison. So the instructions in that prison at that time were the prisoner wasn't to be given the post, but the guards actually said to him, you know, that we have sacks of mail for you. So he did know that people knew about him overseas.
You can imagine that person going through all the cards from over the years that had been sent. It must have been a very emotional moment. I think the other probably impact, David, for whether it's families or individuals, is awareness for ourselves. Because obviously you pick three prisoners from three different countries, and in a lot of these cases, people mightn't have ever even heard of their names. So tell us about the people you've chosen this year.
Okay, the first prisoner on our list is Savada Akhazer. He's from Iran. He's an Orthodox Christian, but he also had fellowship with other Christians and some Christians who had previously been Muslims, and that brought him to the attention of the authorities. So he's somebody whose faith has been steadfast. I mean, he's been arrested in 2014, he's been arrested in 2015, and he was finally summoned to prison last year. And you know, he's a single man, so we don't know how many visits he gets from family and friends. But he's locked away in, you know, a tough prison in Iran. But we're encouraging people to write to Savada, and the cards for Savada are going to a partner organisation of ours called Middle East Concern, and they have channels through which they can get cards to him or his family. So that's Savada in Iran. Second person on our list is Abraham. Abraham Ben Moses. He's from Indonesia. He's a man with a great heart for evangelism, and he's in prison basically because he had a conversation with a taxi driver. And probably all of us have travelled in taxis, and we have heard the wisdom of taxi drivers on all topics under the sun. And in Indonesia, he ended up discussing the Quran with a taxi driver. And Abraham himself used to be a Muslim, but he actually became a Christian when he studied Christianity in a bid to disprove it. And he realised the Bible was true, and he turned to Jesus, and Jesus became his saviour. And now he's an evangelist that wants to encourage others to follow Jesus. So he encouraged the Muslim taxi driver to follow Jesus. But that became public, and he got into trouble. So he's serving a 4-year sentence.
It's something hard to get your head around, isn't it? You have a chat with the taxi driver just about your faith, and you end up in prison for 4 years.
Yes, yes, it is. It's just outside our experience. Well, what about our third prisoner, Bakram from Tajikistan? When you and I go to church, Wendy, we sing Christian songs of all sorts. And many of your listeners will be familiar with songs maybe that glorify the Lord Jesus, that follow biblical imagery of Christians being, soldiers of Christ. And the government in Tajikistan raided Bakram's church a couple of years back. They looked through the hymn book. They saw hymns that would be the equivalent of maybe a well-known hymn like Onward Christian Soldiers. And they said, these are extremists. These are a threat to the state. And of course, it was just an excuse to put Bakram in prison.
They were looking for something too.
They were looking for something. So he's in prison. His wife is very concerned for him. She suffers from hypertension. She had to go to hospital earlier this year. So these are people that are in real need. And, we'd love everybody to adopt one of them.
And add one of those prisoners to your Christmas card list. So in terms of just guidelines, David, what's the practical stuff? What type of cards? What should you and shouldn't you write and all that sort of stuff?
Okay, yes. Well, choose whatever Christmas card you want to send. It doesn't have to be religious, but it doesn't matter if it is religious. I mean, these people are in prison because of their Christian faith, so nobody's going to get worried if there's a card with religious imagery. They will know that it is the faith that these people are in prison for. Put a short greeting inside. Don't write a long greeting. Two of the three prisoners we know don't speak English, and we're not sure about the third. So write their name, just say something like, we're praying for you, or we're thinking of you at Christmas, something short, because there could be somebody in the prison that does speak English and they can interpret it. And don't make any criticism of the government.
Don't politicise it.
Exactly. Don't mention Church in Chains. Don't say anything about their sentence. So that's inside. That's the card. That's the easy bit, Wendy. The envelope might be the more challenging bit. And here is the vital tip. Write the address first. Don't put the stamp on first.
Because the address can be quite long.
The addresses can be quite long. So, if you're planning to do this, get yourself a cup of tea and coffee. Sit down at the kitchen table and just devote a little bit of time to doing this. It'll take you a little bit more time than writing to your Aunt Annie. But it's really something that's very worthwhile. And we know of situations where families have, sat down and done it together.
And talked about these situations. I think it's a really good thing to do as a family, where for your children as well, to have awareness of these things. Just finally, Dave, before you go, you might give us an update on Asia Bibi and her family.
Yes, indeed. This long-running saga is still going on. We all remember that Asia Bibi was released from prison about a month ago. But because of the protests by extremists in Pakistan, the Pakistani government is not allowing her to leave. So she's being held in protective custody. So that means she's being guarded by the Pakistani military. I think, she is being very closely guarded. Her family, though, they are under threat. we have heard reports that where their family lived, extremists have come to that neighbourhood with pictures and saying to people, have you seen this family? So the family have had to move four times in the last month just to keep ahead of...
They're basically on the run from
they
danger.
They are on the run, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, I'd encourage people to continue to pray for Asia Bibi. One of the things that's so really encouraging is that so many people have taken Asia's case to heart. And not just Christians. We have seen in the past month quite an interest from politicians. You'll know that Brendan Howland, the leader of the Labour Party, came along with us to a demonstration at the Pakistani embassy just a couple of weeks back, and he was happy to stand with us and to say how important her case was as an expression of religious freedom and indeed human rights. And just in the past week, a couple of TDs raised her case in the Dáil, and our government has said that if Asia and her family want to come to Ireland, that Ireland would look favourably on such a request. So I think there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
The political pressure is mounting, which is good news. Well, if you want to find out more about the work of Church and Chains and indeed just all the practical stuff in relation to the Christmas card project that the Church and Chains runs, you can go to their website, churchandchains.ie. David, thanks for joining us this morning. Well, have you ever been out for dinner with friends or with a group of friends, and at the end of the evening, you look at all the empty bottles of wine that you've drank, and you kind of realise, how much did we all actually drink? Or maybe you're somebody who enjoys a glass of wine with your dinner, but of course, when you're kind of self-pouring, a large glass at home can be very different to a large glass that you're given in a restaurant. And I think so many people, if I said to you, okay, do you know how many units of alcohol you're meant to drink? As in, what's the safe amount? And do you know how much you're actually drinking? I think a lot of us wouldn't know the answer to that. And when you compare Irish culture when it comes to this issue, we compare us to other European countries, we have a real issue with things like binge drinking, for example. Well, on the line to talk to us a little bit about this topic, about what are safe levels of alcohol consumption, what do we really need to think about in terms of health implications of drinking too much. We have Professor Frank Murray, who's consultant in hepatology and gastroenterology and care of the Alcohol Health Alliance Ireland. Good morning and welcome to the programme, Professor Murray. How are you?
Good morning and thank you for having me here.
Well, put it in context for us. Tell us a little bit about the levels of alcohol we're consuming here in Ireland.
Well, Ireland's one of the heaviest drinking countries in Europe. And it's worth just making a couple of points. First of all, one in two people in Ireland who drinks alcohol drinks in a harmful or hazardous way. In other words, they drink above what are considered low risk levels.
And do they know that they're drinking in a hazardous way?
Well, many of them do, but most people don't. Most people underestimate the amount of alcohol they consume. They miscount the number of standard drinks there are in most of the drinks that people consume. For instance, a lot of people think there are, whom I see in the hospital or in the clinics, would say that they drink, say, they drink four or five glasses of wine, and you ask them, they say, four or five units of wine, and you say, how much is that? And they say, it's a bottle of wine. So a bottle of wine is about seven or eight standard drinks rather than four or five. So there's quite an amount of underestimation of the number of units in the alcohol that people consume. And it's also worth saying there's no safe level of alcohol consumption. You mentioned the word safe level there. There's a low risk level. The only safe level is none. And above that, we consider low risk limits. And there, in Ireland, 11 units for a woman and 17 units for a man.
You see all these probably mythical articles, you know, Professor Murray, and it's interesting that you've highlighted that. Look, it's low risk. It's a risk carried with whatever amount of alcohol you drink. But, you know, obviously we used to have those ads, I remember from years ago, about the iron and a Guinness a day and all that sort of stuff, and constantly seeing these things in tabloid newspapers about, oh, red wine is good for your heart and all that sort of stuff. Are we getting a lot of misinformation when it comes to alcohol?
The evidence in relation to the harms of alcohol have been greatly clarified in recent years, and we're much more confident about that. And the benefits of alcohol from a health point of view have been greatly exaggerated. And I think the idea that you should take a drink to improve your health is a complete myth and should be completely avoided. So the idea that people might take a glass of wine several times a week to improve the health of their heart, there is no excuse for doing that, in my view. The disadvantages of consuming alcohol way overwhelm any minor improvement in cardiac outlook. And the reason for that is that, you know, the tumours in particular are increased in people who even drink relatively small amounts of alcohol, particularly breast cancer, which is something most women don't appreciate. Because the evidence, and the reason they don't appreciate that is not because they're being careless, it's because it's quite hard to find that information. And as you know, there are no warnings currently on alcohol beverages here in Ireland, although that's going to change shortly.
Tell me a little bit about that, just in terms of the increased risk. Let's take breast cancer that you mentioned there, Professor Murray.
Yeah.
And what sort of levels would you need to drink to increase your risk?
Even drinking one standard drink a day, say a small glass of wine, is associated with a 10 or 11% increase in the risk of breast cancer. And it's estimated that in Ireland, about 1 in 8 breast cancers is due to alcohol. So if people didn't drink any alcohol in Ireland, it would be 1 in 8 less breast cancers, which is quite a lot when you think about that, isn't it? Because breast cancer is the commonest malignant tumour in women. So there are, you know, even at low levels of alcohol consumption, we see increased risks of various conditions, including cancer, and including, of course, incidents and accidents, and having something on a night when you go out to drink.
Yeah, and just kind of alcohol-related injuries. In terms of just explaining the kind of low risk versus, because I think we have a huge issue when it comes to binge drinking. You know, you might talk to someone and say, oh, I don't drink from too often, but when I drink, I really drink. Or maybe people don't consider it a binge, but it actually is.
Yeah. Well, Ireland is in the top 2 or 3 in the world for binge drinking. We're the country in the world after, in one of the rankings, we were second only to Austria for binge drinking. So Ireland has a terrible problem with binge drinking. And in fact, the point you make is quite a good one, that many people don't think what they're doing is a binge, like you know, that it's acceptable to, it's acceptable from a health or and well-being point of view and have a lot to drink. The international definitions of binge drinking are 5 or 6 standard drinks in an evening. So that's about 3 pints. Or just over half a bottle of wine. That's what would be considered a binge. And the reason why we're so concerned about people binge drinking is because up to a third of the deaths associated with alcohol and many of the adverse outcomes associated with alcohol relate to the event of drinking. So it's not people drinking just, you know, over years. It's actually just going out and having a fair amount of alcohol to drink and then getting involved in an accident or an incident or a fight or a road incident, or perhaps becoming depressed and taking their own lives. So the actual event of drinking itself, irrespective of its long-term effects, has a substantial risk in terms of adverse outcome.
And in terms of the education piece then, do we have a lot of work to do there? And I think a lot of the things that you've touched on, whether it's the increased risk in breast cancer, but even thinking of our cultural attitude towards alcohol. I know myself, Professor Murray, I wouldn't call myself, I'm kind of an accidental pioneer. I just don't really drink a lot between kind of breastfeeding and being pregnant over the years. And when you go out and you say you're not drinking, people do kind of say, why? Are you sick? Is there something wrong with you?
Yes.
Or ask you if you're pregnant. You know, we do have this kind of cultural obsession with alcohol.
Well, alcohol is pervasive in Irish society. We live in an alcohol saturated society. The point you make is absolutely right. And if you do go out, there's almost a sense of what's wrong with you if you're not consuming alcohol. So I do think we have adopted the wrong attitude to alcohol over time. And we see the consequences of that. Because of that unhealthy relationship we have with alcohol, we drink too much, both overall and in binges. And we have 1,000 deaths per year in Ireland and a $4 billion cost approximately to the exchequer, which is a huge amount of money. So the personal cost to the drinker, the cost, the harm to other people in his life, such as his family and friends, and the cost to society are all very high and reflect that culture of drinking on almost every occasion in Ireland that's become pervasive.
What would be your advice then? I'm thinking now of just one of the points you made there. You know what? 3 drinks, 3 pints, it would be considered a binge, and it would be dangerous if you're doing that on a regular basis. And I'm just thinking of the reaction of if I was to sit down with some friends and say that to them, they'd say, you know, they'd kind of brush you off. Where's the best place that people can go, Professor Murray, to just see, here's the kind of cold hard facts and here's the information on, you know, the amount you're drinking and the amount that's considered low risk versus high risk?
Yeah. So that's a good question. There's a very good website called askaboutalcohol.ie, which is a HSE website which gives objective information in relation to that. I recommend that very highly. And that will allow you also estimate how much you actually drink in the course of a week. And that's a very good exercise for people to undertake. The overall global advice I would give is that given that most people in Ireland who drink alcohol drink in a harmful or hazardous way, is for most people to consider, should I reduce my alcohol consumption? I would argue that many people should say that. Should I reduce the frequency at which I drink, and should I reduce the amount I drink when I go out to binge? I would argue people should reduce the frequency of their alcohol consumption. Personally, I don't drink most weeks from Monday to Thursday or Friday, and restrict whatever alcohol I've consumed to the weekend. And then I don't binge drink because, I feel terrible if I do it, and B, the risk that it puts me at. So I think it's worth making rules that work for yourself and to stay within low-risk guidelines. I might just add, on if I may, the low-risk guidelines for Ireland are 11 units for a woman and 17 standard drinks for a man. In the UK, they're lower. It's 11 units for both men and women.
Why is it different in Ireland then?
Well, our guidelines for low-risk alcohol consumption are quite old, and in fact, they copied the UK limits. The UK limits have recently been adjusted, and I think correctly, they have reduced the threshold for men. And the reason why they did that is quite interesting, because women, we know women are more susceptible to the long-term effects of alcohol for a whole variety of biological reasons than are men. But men are more susceptible to events when they're out drinking, to binge drinking and to getting involved in a row or falling or whatever, having an incident related to drinking, a bit like I discussed earlier on. So for that reason, the guidelines in the UK have said 11 units, in Irish units, per week as a maximum for low-risk alcohol consumption. And they also say that people should avoid binge drinking and that you should take at least 2 or 3 days a week alcohol-free.
Very, very interesting stuff indeed. And I think a lot of people, hopefully after our chat today, Professor Murray, will be engaging a little bit of self-reflection. Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us on Spirit Radio this morning. That's Professor Frank Murray. He's involved, the chair actually of the Alcohol Health Alliance Ireland. That website that Professor Murray mentioned, can I urge you to go and do it now, which is askaboutalcohol.ie. Just to, you can get all the facts and figures there, but just to see, is the amount you're drinking too much? And you know what? The incredible thing is maybe it's just a little bit too much. Maybe you can bring yourself into that low risk category, as Professor Murray made clear. There isn't no risk when it comes to drinking alcohol. There's only low risk, but knowledge is power. Well, we're continuing our regular chat with relationships coach Catherine Gray about the 7 deadly relationship sins. So things that you might be making, mistakes you might be making, especially when you're dating, that could prevent you from meeting the right person. So along the way, we've been talking about scowling and appearing unfriendly when you mightn't actually be at all. It's just that resting unfriendly face that you can have. Talking about yourself too much. Having a checklist was what we talked about last week, where we're looking for too many boxes to tick, often superficial, and that can stop us from even giving someone a chance. And today we're going to be talking about having the wrong attitude and not being interested in people that we meet. On the line to tell us more, we've Catherine Gray, Director of Heavenly Partners. Morning to you, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. Very well, and very excited to be talking about the deadly relationship number 4.
Well, you know, in terms of the time of year it is, there's a lot going on at this time of year, and Christmas probably, in a way, is a good time to meet new people. You might find yourself at social gatherings or different things that you mightn't ordinarily be at, and you get to meet kind of new people. But do we have the wrong attitude some of the time?
Absolutely. Well, Christmas is an absolutely fabulous time to meet new people. It's a real time of opportunity because there are so many social things going on. There's things run by lots of churches. There's carol singing. There's people feeling good at Christmas shopping. There's work parties. There's your own friends' parties. There's so much going on. It's a fabulous time to meet people. But if you're going with the wrong attitude, when you meet certain people, you could really miss out meeting the person that's right for you. So having the wrong attitude is basically judging people too quickly and writing them off and going, no, they're not the type for me, so I'm not going to bother talking to them. And that is a really, really big mistake.
So in terms of, first of all, as we've talked about these various different deadly sins, Catherine, the first thing seems to be awareness. And I think a lot of the time people wouldn't be aware that they actually have this attitude problem in the first place.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, but all of us have experienced it from the other side. We've all experienced when we meet somebody who shows absolutely no interest in us whatsoever. Perhaps they don't even want to say hello, and they certainly don't feel like they've got anything to say to us. And we really feel the brush off, and we're like, well, actually, do you know what? I've got lots to say to you, and I'm an interesting person, but you're just not giving me the time or the space to let me tell you who I am. So if we've experienced it ourselves, which I'm sure we have, then I'm sure the chances are that we will have probably done that to somebody else on occasion as well. And as we've talked before, it's about being aware of that. And it's about saying to ourselves, even if I think this person has got nothing in common with me and that we're never going to go anywhere in terms of friendship or even down the line relationship, it's about saying, no, I'm going to be interested in everybody I meet. I'm going to build rapport with them. I'm going to get to know them. And that's the really, really key thing.
Do you think sometimes this issue starts, Catherine, when we kind of judge a book by its cover, okay? We make a snap judgment. And therefore, because of that wrong snap judgment, often we kind of close our ears. We're not actually listening to them and we don't give them a chance.
Totally and absolutely, completely. I mean, I was so like that with my husband. He didn't really fit any of the criteria that I thought I wanted. And therefore, I wrote him off and didn't want to know. And the awful thing was, is that when you do that with somebody, you don't actually get to know the qualities of their character that lies underneath. So, in fact, my husband is incredibly, I think I've mentioned before, he's incredibly kind and loving and generous and humorous. Now, having written somebody off, you wouldn't get to know whether they're kind or not. And actually, those sort of characteristics are things that are really, really important down the line. So, yes, it's about giving time to people and looking a bit deeper and not seeing just what's on the surface.
So then do you always have to kind of have little ways to really challenge that? And so let's say that situation, like you mentioned there with your husband, Catherine, your initial impression. But if we fall into that trap and we have the wrong attitude, do we almost need to say, OK, when that happens to me, I need to make sure that I ask, you know, a certain number of questions about that person and their life? Or what's the best way to combat it?
Well, I think you should perhaps say, right, every person I'm going to meet, I'm going to spend at least 5 minutes talking to. Because it's really easy if you're at a party and you're looking across the room and you think, oh, well, there's a nice person over there, or there's a nice person over there, and they're nicer than this person I'm talking to right now. It's to commit to yourself before you even go to that social situation that you're going to spend at least 5 minutes. And perhaps something would be good to do to say, right, I'm going to find out 3 things about that person. And I'm going to not move on until I've found out 3 things about them. So you force yourself to sort of spend time with them. You can call it as a research project if you want. I'm researching the people that are in this party or in this social gathering with me. And trick your mind like that to sort of overcome your initial prejudice, your initial feeling that you're not interested in that particular person, and trick your mind to say, well, actually, I might not be interested in them, but I'm going to find out lots about them. And that's where you might then trick your mind and actually discover that actually they are quite interesting, or they're actually quite funny, because you allow them time to bring that side of themselves out. And perhaps they tell you a joke and you think, oh, actually, I'll give him a second chance. And I think we've all experienced that before, haven't we, where we think we've judged somebody and then they surprise us. So yeah, that's the way to do it. Say you're going to spend at least 5 minutes talking to each person would be a good start.
I think a good way also, I'm just thinking about it as thinking, put the shoe on the other foot. In other words, how would you feel if someone was thinking about you in that way and they're making a snap judgment? Happens to me all the time. I present a Christian radio show, so people imagine you to be all sorts of things because you're very open about being Christian, for example. And then they're very surprised when you have a sense of humour, for example. So it's, we wouldn't like to think of people judging us in that way. So probably not nice that we do it, even if it's subconsciously ourselves.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the whole idea is to build rapport with people and to get people's trust, because as you do that, people will reveal themselves to you. And I think the other thing, Wendy, is it's about also recognizing that men and women are different. So for women, it's about not just talking about feelings and emotions, because we're really good about doing that, but it's about including facts in our discussions with men and asking them about the things they're interested in. And if you're a man, it's not just talking about facts, it's about asking about emotions and feelings and being aware of that in your conversation with the other person. So perhaps if you think, oh, I'm talking to a woman and all I ever talk to about my mates is football, perhaps you can say, well, how are you feeling about the run-up to Christmas, and how are you feeling about getting together with your family? And if you're a woman, you might be you know, asking the guy about their football team or what things they're going to be doing over Christmas or what presents they've bought. So it's about trying to build rapport with the opposite sex in new ways and being interested. And as I've said, it's very, very important that even if you don't like them, that they come away with a positive impression of you. Because even if you're not right them, they might then go to their friends and say, do you know what, I've just met this absolutely lovely woman. Now, I would really like to introduce you. And that's another way of meeting people. So that's terribly important as well. So it's all about good impressions. And that is about having the right attitude towards everybody you meet.
Have you seen a situation, Catherine, in your work helping people to find love? Have you seen it turn around? Because it's not easy to, if this has kind of been your attitude for quite some time, it's not easy to change it overnight.
It's not. Now we have a lovely, lovely example. It's on our website of a couple called Heather and Dave. Now Heather had a disastrous marriage with somebody who fitted her criteria. She'd married this guy. He seems like he was everything she wanted, but they'd actually had a very, very unhappy marriage. And she kept on dating more people. Once they split up and she was divorced, she kept on dating people who, again, were what she thought was her right criteria. But as a result, she kept on dating and it wasn't going anywhere. And then she began to pray about it and she realized that she needed to stop writing people off. And by this time she'd met this guy, Dave, and they'd had one date, but nothing had really happened. And she thought, well, it's not going anywhere. We haven't really got much in common. But after she prayed about it, and she thought, right, I'm going to stop writing people off like I have been. She thought, okay, I'll go back to Dave and we'll start communicating. And amazingly, they discovered that they had more things in common than they first thought and actually began to realize that they complemented each other in their strengths and weaknesses. And absolutely beautifully, Dave had been advised by his friends to take it slowly. And their relationship, they got to know each other, they absolutely blossomed, and they have the most beautiful marriage.
So that was a classic case
of somebody writing somebody off and then realizing that she'd done the wrong thing and she needed to reevaluate. And so she went back to the guy she'd met. And the rest is history. So it's a good example.
It's a good example of just sometimes where we think we've got it all sussed out in terms of what we actually need, but we could have it totally all wrong. And I think one of the key things, and you've touched on it in a few of the relationship sins we've been talking about, Catherine, is, you know, it takes time to get to know somebody. You know, some people, for example, when you first meet them, they might appear to, let's say, be really shy or not chatty. And then the more you get to know them, they come out of their shell and it's like you're speaking to a different person after a few meetings with them.
Absolutely.
And is it about that? Is it about giving somebody time as well?
It absolutely is. It's about that. It's about we're complex human beings. I mean, I'm horrified when I hear people ring us up and say, oh, I've been on one date and he's not the one for me. I'm like, how can you possibly say that? You know, you can't be described in 1 hour, or somebody can't get to know you fully in 1 hour. And okay, you might come across as vivacious and outgoing because you're a presenter. But actually, there's much, much more to your character, much more in depth. And that's the same for all of us. And we need to give people time. You can't rush these things.
What would you say then to someone, let's say, Catherine, someone listening at the moment, and, you know, they're thinking of some social gatherings that they might be at over Christmas, or think events they're going to go to where they might meet new people. How do they go into those situations? What should they think about in terms of having the right attitude?
Well, one of the things I think to think is to get rid of the idea that you're searching for your soulmate, because that puts you under a lot of pressure.
And you're also kind of looking at people in a kind of utilitarian way. You're not useful to me for what I'm looking for right now. It's not very nice.
Absolutely. So to go into those social situations, just think, right, I am going to try and see if I can make lots of new friends here. That is going to be my aim, to increase my social circle by 5 or 7 or 10 people. I mean, 10 would be a huge lot from one night. But actually, it's doable. If you really have got the right attitude and you approach people in the right way and you're really interested in them, they will be attracted to you and probably want to stay in touch with you, want to introduce you to their friends or their family. So that's what I would say. Take the pressure off yourself. Don't think you're going out to meet the one this Christmas at that Christmas party, but say, I am going out to, A, practice my skills in not having the wrong attitude, and I'm going to make as many friends as I possibly can. And that would be a really good way to go into The next 21 days before Christmas, meeting as many new people as you can.
Really good advice, as always, Catherine. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Catherine Gray there. She's the founder and director of Heavenly Partners. We will be continuing our 7 Deadly Relationship Sins chat. We'll be on sin number 5 next week. And if you'd like to learn more about getting relationships right from the beginning, or you'd like more info about meeting someone who shares your Christian faith, you can get in touch with Catherine at Heavenly Partners. Their website there is heavenlypartners.ie, or you can give her a buzz on 01531499. This is shopping going. One of the things that I love getting and love receiving is books. I actually think it's a really personal gift when you find something, you know, when you see something, you go, oh, that person would love that book. And also, it's really nice. I had an experience recently with a cousin of mine where I had kind of given her some books that I had read, right? And then we were able to kind of chat about it, and you have this nice kind of rapport then with someone when you're talking about books that you both have liked. I have a brilliant selection of books in front of me that I'm going to be talking with my next guest about, which might give you some ideas for Christmas gifts, or indeed you might be thinking, I'm putting my feet up for a few days over the Christmas period in front of the fire, and I'm looking for a few good reads. Well, on the line to give us a bit of a roundup of some of the books I have in front of me, I have Elaine Egan, who's Group PR and Communications Manager for Hashit Books, and she's on the line now. Elaine, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Well, I'm going to start off with one that I'm really looking forward to flicking through. We actually interviewed Doreena Allen here on the programme a few weeks ago, and it was just such a lovely interview to talk to such a stalwart of cooking. And for me, and I think for a lot of people listening, I remember the original Simply Delicious books. I used to play cooking in the kitchen, again with a cousin, where we'd have the Doreena Allen glasses on, and I think there's a lot of lovely nostalgia in this book. So she has brought together this book, which is the classic collection. So it's basically, she was saying to us at the interview, Elaine, that people kept coming to her saying, how do I get the originals? And of course they were out of print because they were so popular.
Yeah, so the first book was published in 1986, and it broke publishing records. They ran out of paper, there were queues around the block for signing, and so everyone, I think my mother included, has all of the Doreena Allen cookbooks wrapped in cling film in the kitchen. And as they're out of date now, there was such a demand there, we wanted to update them and re-photograph them into this beautiful package, a classic collection for all time. These are dishes that have stood the test of time over nearly 30 years. And as you said, Doreena, queen of Irish cooking. And I was telling her, I once dressed up as Doreena Allen for a fancy dress competition.
I'm sure you weren't alone there, Elaine. There's lots of people with the classic red glasses. But, yeah, you know, one of the lovely things about this book is just bringing it back to basics. I'm looking at the traditional Irish bacon. And I think there's probably a lot of people, you know, in their 20s, 30s that have never made this Irish classic. And there are things that once you know how to make it, you can make it for years to come.
That's just it. The recipes are so easy and accessible. I mean, they're all ingredients that most people would have in their cupboards, if not in their local stores. And Doreena has always kind of been focused on kind of fresh produce. And they really are beautiful recipes and perfect for Christmas. There are some beautiful turkey marjoram in there, a lovely lemon stuff, actually, which I tried to make recently, which was absolutely delicious. So the perfect recipe book to pour over this Christmas with loved ones.
One of the things that we talked with Doreena about when she was on was just bringing it back to just a lot of us actually just need to learn how to cook again, and that's beneficial for so many reasons, let alone our health. But one of the difficulties I think that people have, Elaine, is time. So this next book might be good for those middle of the week, you know, when it's kind of Wednesday and you're tired and you do want to cook from scratch but you haven't got a lot of time. Donal Skean has a book out, it's called Meals in Minutes. Tell us about this one.
So it's 90 simple everyday recipes that are strict back to the basics, but all taste delicious. So as you said, people are, you know, caught for time. You know, they just want to have something simple that they can make at home in the evening. And it's minimal equipment and ingredients which just deliver the speediest suppers. So it's the perfect thing for any kind of families on the go. And as many people will probably have watched Donal's RTE TV series, which was on recently, of the same name. And when you watch that and you reflect back on the recipes, you see how easy and accessible they are. And Donal, oh, such a much loved name, I think, in Irish cookery now.
And you know what? I'm looking at there's a section of the book called One Pot. I definitely like One Pot, let alone because it means less cleaning of lots of different dishes. But I went out and I bought a giant, you know, stainless steel pot to do batch cooking. And in the One Pot section, you know, things like the paella dinner, the veggie dal, they're things that you can actually cook in batch lots and freeze them. So they are very practical, these recipes.
And perfect, especially at this time of year when the temperatures are dropping and you want something hearty and warm to keep you going through the long January nights ahead, I think.
This one is definitely intriguing. Tell us a little bit about Toto the Ninja Cat and the Incredible Cheese Heist. I'm guessing it's a fiction.
It is fiction. And this is the second book by the X Factor presenter Dermot O'Leary. And it's a continuation of the adventures of Toto the Ninja Cat, who is nearly blind but doesn't let that stop him on his adventures. And in this book, he's on a mission to find who has stolen all of the cheese in the world. And actually, Toto was inspired by Dermot's own cat, Toto, who he rescued on a trip to Italy. So his own cat was actually blind, and he found that he actually had quite ninja-like movements. So that's what Dermot based it on. And it has beautiful black and white illustrations, and it really is the perfect gift for parents to read aloud or for children to read alone.
Yeah, what sort of age would you recommend this particular book for then, Elaine?
It's middle grade, so it's 7+.
Seven plus. And as you say, something that's really nice for parents to read with their children, something I just think we need to do more of, you know, curl up together, read the story together. They are memories you will never forget. And also, there is a really great message in this book, because Toto isn't letting anything hold him back from what he needs to do in terms of finding and saving the cheese.
Exactly. Sense of adventure is always there, and Toto's just a great character to bring children out and get them excited.
This next book I'm really interested to learn more about. I think we're becoming more and more aware of looking after ourselves. We've been talking about, you know, cooking from scratch and healthy eating, but another thing is that we're becoming more aware about is our skin and kind of what we're putting onto our skin. And there's a girl called Jennifer Rock. She's written a book called The Skin Nerd. So some of the listeners might have heard of her. She's an award-winning lecturer, and this book is really kind of bringing together a lot of her advice. And but it's quite straight talking. I think people kind of get bogged down, especially when it comes to skincare. There's just kind of so much to take in. It's like you almost shut down. But this is really accessible for everybody.
Really accessible. And I mean, the great thing about this book is that, you know, it doesn't focus on specific skin brands or anything like that that you need to buy. It's very much, Jennifer very much focuses on the importance of what you're putting into your body as well as what you're putting onto your skin. So it includes advice on about skin needs for every stage of your life. And it really is a beautiful book with everything that you could possibly need. It has advice on acne, anti-aging and other skin conditions, the kind of things skin ingredients you need to look out for. So I find that very helpful, because I'm hearing about all these different kind of chemicals and you're not quite sure what serum you should be buying. But it's great to kind of strip it back to the basics of, okay, what kind of things should you be looking out for in the products you use?
Just breaking down some of the, you know, the phrases or the buzzwords we might hear, and you see them on products, but you don't really know what they're. Things like free radicals. It's like, okay, well, what are they? Explain them to me, and why are they bad?
Exactly. And Jennifer basically wants to instill as much confidence in the readers as possible. She has a really successful online skin consultation business called theskinnerd.com. So that's where we actually first came across Jennifer. Which is doing extremely well. And we're having a really hard time keeping this on bookshelves this Christmas. It really is the beauty bible for all your skin needs.
It is. It's quite funny as well. It's quite humorous. It's not preachy at
all.
I'm looking at a page which I can identify with. Do you want to pop that spot? And she's kind of saying, okay, this is what you need to think about before you even go there. And it's like step by step. Here's what you should do. Here's what you should do. Just really kind of practical, and you can dip in and out of it. So that one is called This Skin Nerd. I need to become a bit more of a skin nerd, to be honest with you, and to get a bit more up to speed on things. This next one, I think people across the country will, it's a lovely kind of coffee table book to have, which people really might have kind of forgotten, just our rich history when it comes to horses and horse racing in Ireland. It's called Winners, and it's about the horses, the memories and defining moments. But this book, it's bringing together lots of different contributions from really well-known trainers. Tell us a little bit more about it, Elaine.
So it's a beautiful coffee table book, as you said, and it very much is nostalgic in a sense that it has interviews of some of the top names in horse racing. And as you mentioned, I mean, we have such a rich history in Irish horse racing with some fantastic jockeys and trainers and owners. So it has those interviews with talking from people like Ruby Walsh, AP McCoy, Willie Mullins, Jessica Harrington, just to name but a few. And it features all the top horses that they loved and have memories of throughout the years. And it's written by Hugh Cahill, who's a sports broadcaster and commentator for RTE. So, you know, he has the inside track, if you'll excuse the pun, on all of the racing history. And it really is, you know, coming up to the Christmas racing time, it really is the perfect gift for any kind of racing enthusiast.
It's one of the parts of Irish culture and our history when you look at some of the winners over the years that we punch way above our weight, and Irish horses are famous all over the world. And I just think it's a really, really interesting read, I have to say. And people from across the country, they're going to want to dip into the trainers and the horses that they know were trained in their neck of the woods. I think people will like that. More on animals, actually. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about this one. It's a number one bestseller already. It's Noel Fitzpatrick and it's called Becoming the Super Vet, Listening to Animals. So for people who don't know much about Noel, tell us a little bit about him and this book, Elaine.
So Noel is originally actually from Ballyfin, County Laois, where he grew up on a farm there. And this book is his memoir, which explores his journey to becoming the super vet. It's a Channel 4 TV series, which has grown hugely in popularity. And in the TV series, Noel takes on difficult cases with animals. There was a situation recently where he had fitted a cat with two bionic legs, which was the first of its kind.
Wow.
And it's a really beautiful memoir talking about his love of animals and what they have taught him. Especially he shares a lot about his beloved scruffy border terrier, Kira, who has kind of taught him a lot of lessons in life. And all throughout, it's all about the animals, basically, who have kind of instilled in him, given him a sense of peace at difficult times. And, you know, it's very much about treasuring your pets.
So, yeah, it's really one for animal lovers. I loved when he talked about one of his sheepdogs, Pirate, and who just helped him at a time when he was younger and he was in school and he was being bullied. And it is true. It's like, you know, man's best friend, and just amazing thing of what animals can teach us. So I think animal lovers will really, really like that book. I know there's a lot more to get through, but we've time possibly just to get to one more of the books, which is Chris Hoy's How to Ride a Bike from Starting Out to Peak Performance. What's it all about?
So this is a fantastic book. It's from, as you said, Sir Chris Hoy, one of Great Britain's most successful Olympic athletes of all time, 6 gold medals and 1 silver. And it's an invaluable manual for cyclists of all ages, experience and ability, whether you're starting out or whether you're kind of moving forward in your cycling. And it has a great practical advice on strength and conditioning to improve your performance, training plans, kind of to focus on building up your strength, and different riding terrains, you know, bike essentials, everything you need to know about cycling and how to improve your performance in cycling. So definitely one for those who, you know, who maybe a few people are getting new bikes this Christmas, so they'll get out on the road and start training for different things, triathlons and so on. So this is the perfect gift for those.
Elaine, a great selection for us this morning. Thanks so much for giving us that preview, and lots of food for thought on Christmas gifts and hopefully getting some time to read over Christmas as well. Thanks for talking to us on Spirit Radio this morning. That's Elaine Egan there. She's Group PR and Communications Manager for Hachette Books. And all those books, of course, are available on their website, but all of them are available in all good bookstores. As they say, what a great selection. From cooking to animals to looking after your skin.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.